Pope Francis continues his recovery from double pneumonia in Rome, and the new Cardinal Archbishop is installed in Washington, D.C., but not without controversy. The papal posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, return with analysis. Actor and comedian Joe Piscopo discusses his legendary career in a brand new memoir, Average Joe. And a wave of violence has swept over Syria, killing more than 1,300 religious minorities, including Christians. Who's responsible and what's being done about it? Nina Shea and Father Benedict Keeley are here with the latest. The World Over starts right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Pope Francis's health condition remains guarded, but according to the Vatican updates, he continues to improve. He was admitted to the hospital on February 14th, and there are new developments in the Marco Rupnik scandal and Cardinal Robert McElroy, who was officially installed as the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C. Here with an analysis of all of that and much more is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer, priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Thank you both for being here. Gents, Pope Francis had another restful night. Imagine that, according to the Vatican. That seems to be the repeated update every morning. The Pope rested. He had a restful night. He slept well. Okay. 27 days at Rome's Gemelli Clinic. He's continuing to receive high-flow oxygen therapy during the day and non-invasive mechanical ventilation at night. The health briefings are becoming less frequent. He's not been seen in public, however, since being admitted. But as we showed our audience last week, he had a public utterance, this audio message where he sounded very weak. And, of course, March 13th marks the 12th anniversary of his election. Father Murray, I'll start with you. Your thoughts on the 12th anniversary of this pontificate and the Pope's condition?
Yes, Raymond, we were all there in Rome 13 years ago, and it was a big surprise when the Pope from Argentina was elected, because we knew that he had been the runner-up at the previous election in which Benedict XVI was elected, but it really wasn't expected. And I guess I could say, honestly, the way the pontificate has gone really wasn't expected either, because this is probably the most controversial pontificate, certainly in my lifetime, 20th century and 21st century. He's unlike any other pope that I've ever studied or known. And as a result, there is a lot of crisis and confusion in the church. The whole synod on synodality matter is hanging over us, a new style of being church. Where that's going to go from here on out is unknown, but certainly we're praying for him in his suffering. I've had pneumonia. I know what it's like not to be able to breathe. And at his age, and having now had the pneumonia for about 4 weeks, this is serious. So hopefully he can improve, but he's in suffering a lot. So we pray that God relieve that.
Yeah. Bob, I want your impressions of these ongoing Vatican updates. Every day we get these updates, and basically it's, the Pope rested well, which, that's not really an update. I mean, the medical updates are far more substantial, and we're getting those, every so often, usually in the afternoons, but now they're spaced out. Your reaction to that and where we really are. I mean, I had someone tell me in Rome this week, look, he still has pneumonia.
Well, look, we've all complained for years and years about the way that the Vatican press office handles events. And I mean, the possible death of a pope might be the most sensitive thing of all. And so you understand in a way that they don't want to be sensationalistic. They want to put the best face on things. They want to give us the idea that the pope is in good spirits. Mm-hmm. He sleeps well. He's cooperative, with the therapies that they're providing. But one has to assume, as Father said, if you've had pneumonia or if you've had a serious breathing difficulty, that there's a lot more to the story. And God bless him. There have been a lot of prayers that have been said for him. The St. Peter's Square has been full of people saying rosaries for him night after night. But I think we can assume that there's a lot more that's behind that. And it's going to be interesting to see now what the segue is, because the doctor said he would be at least in the hospital for a few more days.
Yeah.
Well, we're into a weekend almost, and I think it's probably going to go through the weekend. And there are rumors in Rome that there has now been a kind of a medical suite set up at Santa Maria Maggiore.
Well, why? And just to tell people, that's not the Vatican. No. Santa Maria Maggiore is a basilica in Rome where the Pope goes to pray. His tomb is going to be there. But why would you set up a medical suite there?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to have a medical explanation for that. Obviously, yeah. If they really wanted to, they could have done that in Casa Santa Marta, which is where he normally lives. Mm-hmm. You know, it may just be that he needs more isolation because there are an awful lot of people who are going in and out of Santa Marta. And as you rightly say, he has a real affection for Our Lady of the Roman People, you know, Our Lady Salus Populi Romani, yeah. Which is this famous image. It was one of the first images he visited when he was elected pope 13 years ago today, or 12 years ago today. And he visits it before and after many of his trips as well. So he's got an affection for that. And maybe if it's true that they're setting up that medical suite, yeah. Maybe it's a sign that that's where he wants to be at the very end.
Yeah, Father, as part of these daily reports, we hear the Pope is praying. He receives the occasional visitor, conducts papal business throughout this moment of convalescence. And we've heard reports of visits from the Cardinal Secretary of State, Parolin, as well as rumors of visits by Jesuit canonist Cardinal Ghirlanda. We referenced him during our last time on the show here. I sat down with Father Robert Sirico on my Arroyo Grande podcast this week, and he shared talk of a possible rule change to the general congregation. Now, those are the meetings of cardinals that happen before a conclave. Watch.
I don't know if any of this is true. We have to see. But the gossip is, there's several of these rumors, is that the chief canonist, Cardinal Ghirlanda, also a Jesuit, has been in and out of the room, and that they have been working on a document that will revise that governing document that governs the transition and the conclave and the election. And that in this document, it indicates, and this is where the rumor is. I don't know if this is true or not, but it's not uninformed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. That would say that there won't be these congregations, or if there are these congregations, they will follow the method of meeting that the Synod had, which is rather than just a series of conversations and lectures by the cardinals over X number of days, that they sit around a table with 10 people and all express themselves, say a little prayer, and then have it all redacted. And then the redactor would say, this is the consensus at the table.
So the rumor is it's controlled speech like the Synod, yes, rather than an open conversation among equal cardinals. So this would be Pope Francis trying to control the outcome of that general congregation.
And that maybe lay people, like at the Synod, lay people and non-cardinals, could be added to that conversation. It's a conversation. It's not the vote. So that's one of the rumors that's going around, and has really been pushed by some, you know, notable, you know, influential Jesuits.
Father, your thoughts on this, and would a rule change to include laity in these general congregations during the interregnum conclave process be canonically kosher?
Well, the Pope is the chief legislator, so he can change the law. Would it be wise and prudent? Absolutely not. I mean, this is, I mentioned that synodality matter hanging over the church. If in the name of synodality, we claim that everybody from lay people to deacons and priests and women and men religious, along with bishops and cardinals, have to be in these meetings that are held up till now by the College of Cardinals alone, that's changing the whole thing. And that creates a whole dynamic because, of course, if a meeting is held between all the cardinals, including the ones over age 80, well, these are all cardinals. That's part of their job. They're responsible. They know each other. They're also all shepherds in the church. If now lay people, and who's going to pick them, by the way, that's always the question. If they're there, I can see a pressure dynamic building where you'll have, you know, let's be blunt, radical Catholics who are unhappy that women can't be ordained getting up and saying the next pope has to be a prophet. He's got to have to ordain women. And then the cardinals are all sitting there and saying, well, wait a minute. We're here to talk among ourselves about who's the best candidate. This forum, as I'm speculating, could be used for pressure groups. So I would be very worried. The idea that everything that's inherited by the from the church's past has to be reexamined and questioned and even cast aside, that's a revolutionary dynamic that unfortunately in this pontificate has gotten legs. We got to stop this. The College of Cardinals are pastors. They're not bureaucrats waiting for experts to tell them what they need to do.
Yeah. Bob, I imagine the papal posse will not be invited to address the general congregations. But should we be preparing ourselves for a conclave on synodality?
Well, you know, one of the ironies about this rumor, if it proves to be.
And it is a rumor. We should stipulate that once more.
Is that Jorge Mario Bergoglio was not very well known to the other cardinals when he was elected 12 years ago today.
Yeah.
And it was his performance, and it was a performance. He gave a discourse at the general congregations that convinced a lot of people that he was going to be the reformer for the church. I've talked with a couple of cardinals who voted for him and kind of indicated without telling me how they voted in the actual conclave with a little bit of buyer's remorse that they just said, you know, one of them, an American cardinal, said to me, I just felt that God wanted him to be pope. So it's ironic that he wants to change the form on which he himself was able to present himself to the other cardinals. And I think that these small group discussions, look, there's a role for every type of discussion in the world. But what we really need, I think, going forward in the next papacy, I'm going to kind of be a prophet now, because we need someone who is conspicuously spiritual. I think we have too much conversation about worldly matters, too little about what the church's lane is, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And the other two things, quite bluntly, are we need reform of finances. You know, there's still a lot of murkiness around the Vatican finances and a crisis of support.
Well, this is the same thing we were talking about 12 years ago, Bob. And Bergoglio was elected to fix the finances, fix the Curia, right?
Right. And the other thing, obviously, is the sexual abuse crisis.
Yes.
I know we're going to talk about some of that going forward. Yeah. But those two things, and plus being conspicuously spiritual, I don't know that you can gauge who ought to be pope on the basis of these roundtable discussions. I think you need someone who projects something and that you can see that he's going to project something in public.
Yeah, and you tipped us off on this, talking about the sex abuse thing. A big story this week is the ongoing scandal of disgraced Jesuit Marco Rupnik. Rupnik continues to operate as a priest despite accusations of abusing at least 40 women religious over a span of 20 years. Again, a friend of Pope Francis's who was excommunicated, then unexcommunicated. Now he's a priest in good standing again. Another possible victim, a religious sister, has come forward with her story after two others did the same last year. This week, an Italian reporter confronted Rupnik about the accusations at the baggage claim at Rome's airport. Here's some of what happened.
No. Mi scusi se la disturbo. Senta, volevamo capire come mai lei non si è difeso pubblicamente mai da queste gravi accuse che queste suore le hanno.
Father, we've been covering this story for what seems like an eternity. What did you make of that confrontation? And are we still waiting for the Vatican to hand down a canonical sentence, perhaps of spiritual abuse in the Rupnik case?
Well, I'll ask the audience, does that look like an innocent man in front of you? No. This reminds me of other, perpetrators who are ambushed, so to speak, by the media. And then what do? They put their hand in front of the camera and then they try to run away. Now, we know that this the investigation, the Vatican said that it's under investigation. But it's been going on a year and a half. I think they could have convicted him within 3 months based on the evidence that was already presented by previous investigations. Nonetheless, Cardinal Fernandez said that there's going to be a judicial process, meaning that he'll have a church trial.
Yeah.
Well, we've never heard about the trial. Cardinal Fernandez said that I think in January they're going to get a panel of judges and the like. But where is it? Why hasn't it been named? It's very sad to say the canon law is often done behind closed doors. And that's not how justice systems in the modern world work. This should have been known. There's also a rumor now out that the decision will be handed down shortly.
Yeah, OSV which I hope is reporting that.
Yeah, I hope, exactly. OSV reports it. Now, you know, this is The thing is, when has the trial been? Has the trial already happened? Did Rupnik testify? Who were the witnesses? None of that is known. There's something called an administrative process, which means that you don't really have to do all the same formalities. Was that invoked? That was used to remove Cardinal McCarrick from the priesthood. So all I can say, Raymond, on this case is this man was excommunicated because he absolved an accomplice in a base sin, which undoubtedly that accomplice most likely was coerced. He was already excommunicated. We know this history. When you have a perpetrator who's then convicted, becomes a guilty party, and then other witnesses come forward, the credibility of those witnesses is almost universally confirmed because they're saying the same thing that's already been found to have happened. So It's taken much too long. And we do look ridiculous that this man has no precautions. In the United States, if man had 40 accusations against him, he would not be allowed to conduct public ministry as a priest. Now, Rupnik, of course, wasn't wearing a collar, but he's still Father Rupnik, and he responded to that. So thank God that this process apparently is going to come to a conclusion. I hope it's a just conclusion.
Bob, how devastating is this video and the facts of this case? I mean, we have other priests who've been stripped of their faculties at lightning speed for daring to face East or hold a traditional mass. Where is the justice in this case? Yeah. And has there been a carve-out for Rupnik, as there were for other bishops who've offended in the past? Yeah.
No, I think it's even worse than that. I personally know of at least two priests, American priests. Yeah. I mean, people talk about the church still not having resolved the abuse problem. And, of course, you could criticize parts of what it is. But I know of at least two priests who were just accused of something that actually seemed to me very light and were removed from the organizations in which they were working. And went years before there was any determination, but were removed, were not publicly functioning as priests, were not involved in any church activities, certainly were not allowed to be near people, whether adults or children, that they had been accused of doing something with before. And they were both exonerated. I mean, it took a long time for that to happen. But here we have a very prominent figure. His father says, I mean, the evidence... We don't know what kind of trial is taking place, but the evidence quite clearly points to a conviction. And he goes on and on. We know that he was taken out to a kind of a monastery outside of Rome by Cardinal Donatius, mm-hmm. which is given special favor on top of just this thing going on and on and on. So how devastating is it? Well, I have to think that for victims around the world, it's absolutely horrifying. But for the average Catholic, you look at this and you say, well, what kind of level playing field is this? Some people get, we talk about two-tiered policing. Yeah. Some people get special deals and other people get removed on the slightest rumor or accusation.
But the question has to be raised, and I hate to be the one that has to raise it, but we have to because it's honest and it's truthful. You had Zanchetta. You had all these bishops, cardinals, in some cases, very close to the Pope, who were given their own lane of justice, Father, and they were free to operate. And really, it took in the case of one of these bishops, it took the Argentine authorities petitioning to drag him back there because he'd been found guilty in the civil courts before the church finally said, "Okay, you can have him." I mean, this is not just; it's not fair.
No, and it makes the church look ridiculous, which means you can laugh at what the church says, that it's upholding standards of justice. You're referring to Bishop Zanchetta, who was the spiritual directee of Pope Francis when he was bishop in Buenos Aires. He was the first bishop named in Argentina by Pope Francis after he became pope. Bishop Zanchetta was convicted and jailed for sexual abuse against seminarians.
Right.
He was released from jail on a mercy petition because of his so-called illness. And then he was, who knows where he is. The reports were that he was in Rome. But this is about 4 or 5 years ago. A canonical process was announced by the Vatican at the time. We've never heard anything, whether that process actually happened, whether it concluded, whether he found guilty or innocent. But why in the world was Zanchetta given favor? Meanwhile, Bishop Daniel Fernandez, who was a good bishop in Puerto Rico, who had disputes with the other bishops, he was removed from office unceremoniously. No decree given to him stated what happened, because there couldn't be a decree that would be just because he had done nothing wrong. He had a few disagreements with other bishops. Yeah. Well, guess what? That's life. Yeah. So, no, when you say two-tier justice system, you can say, look, Bishop Strickland was thrown out of his diocese because he didn't cooperate with some of the things he was supposed to cooperate with. But wait a minute. Zancheta went to jail, and he still hasn't been removed from the priesthood for abusing a seminary. This is wrong.
Yeah, no, it's outrageous. It's outrageous, and it's a pity more Catholics don't know about it, but they don't because, as you said, we never get the results of these canonical trials. Gentlemen, before we run out of time, another big story. This week in Washington, we saw the official installation at the Mass of Cardinal Robert McElroy. It took place at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. Various reports have said the installation took place before a full house. Then there were photos where they showed a less than full basilica. I wasn't there. I can't say one way or the other. But the incoming 8th Archbishop of Washington has said he has no plans to meet with President Donald Trump, but has recently spoken at length to former President Joe Biden about Pope Francis's health, etc. Quickly to both of you, Bob, then Father, your thoughts on the new Archbishop and what seemed to be a snub of the current occupant of the White House. And given the pastoral concerns the bishops have that touch on federal policy, wouldn't it be wise to at least say, okay, I'm going to make an effort to at least reach out to the administration?
Yeah, I think if you're Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C., you have to be Cardinal Archbishop of both parties. I mean, it's painful in some respects in either party, but you have to be at least projecting that that's what you're going to be doing. My greater worry is about what he is as a theologian, if I can put it that way, because he's certainly come out very strongly in favor of LGBT people. He's talked about the church's teaching about homosexuality as a barrier. We shouldn't erect barriers to the Eucharist in the name of Eucharistic coherence, which was one of the things that the Pope said about Biden. He said that Biden needs to practice Eucharistic coherence. He's proposing a kind of a changing in our theology of the Eucharist by which if you commit a mortal sin, somehow that doesn't—it doesn't separate you from the body. That means you in a way, it's almost a greater recommendation for you to receive the Eucharist. So I'm worried about that. I'm worried about the way that I think that he's probably believing that he can wade into political issues when I think it's much wiser for a Cardinal Archbishop of Washington to try to speak out when there are very, very clear moral questions at stake. But otherwise, practice a certain asceticism.
Yeah. Father, I'll give you a crack at that question about whether he should be reaching out.
In the Synodal Church, which Cardinal McElroy was at the Synod, he's the representative of that way of thinking, it's about dialogue. And now he's already announcing he doesn't want to talk to the President of the United States. That's contradictory. It's a big mistake. And Bob is right. You have to be a bishop for all Catholic people, Democrat and Republican. And, you know, what his whole history, as Bob noted, his theological pronouncements and really innovations which contradict Catholic teaching. We've also got to look at the history of sexual abuse because he's under accusation by a victim of a satanic rape by a priest, now an ex-priest, called Bertrand Jacob. Are you going to refer to this?
I'm going to play. I want to play a little clip of that. And, you know, as we mentioned, this McElroy's installation was not without controversy. Just outside, there were Catholics protesting McElroy's installation because of alleged mishandling of sex abuse cases when he served as Bishop of San Diego. Abuse victim Rachel Mastro Giacomo accuses Cardinal McElroy of being complicit in covering up her rape. Watch.
I'm here to tell the truth. The truth is that I was exposed to a very dark predator who ritually abused me within the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. This happened in the summer of 2010. He eventually was found guilty in criminal court of this crime, and Cardinal McElroy was complicit in covering up my ritual rape. He was criminally complicit.
Father, San Diegans have heard this allegation of cover-up for a long time, but it's probably new to a lot of Washingtonians and a national audience. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no. Remember, the mantra was, we have victims, we have to listen to them. So Rachel deserves to be heard. And what is her request? Her request is that Cardinal McElroy address the history of what he did when he became aware of this priest, Jacob Bertrand, his evil acts, and what he did in response to it. Because Rachel says that the diocese was not cooperative when he was the bishop. Right. This all happened before he became bishop, by the way, the crime. But afterwards, when he was called to account before the justice system, the claim by Rachel is that the system did not, the diocese did not cooperate. So let's get all the facts out here. We need to know because, of course, expectations for how a bishop's going to treat these matters in the future is largely based on how they've treated them in the past. And if he has a record of being accused of being lax or not cooperative, he should want to clear the deck on that.
Yeah, and he's also occupying a see that was McCarrick's cardinalatial see, and then Donald Wuerl's cardinalatial see, both of whom, you know, struggled with charges of not responding to sex. One was actually a predator, one who actually guilty of these crimes, the other with pushing them aside or not addressing them.
Yeah, he's been saying over the years, because he was alerted by Richard Sipe, a very famous person who was following these abuse charges. He was given material about McCarrick. Cardinal McElroy was given the information by Richard Sipe. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you look at the history of that, we all knew about Cardinal McCarrick back in the day. Everybody knew about this, and I'm sure Cardinal McElroy knew about it as well. But there seems to have been a will not to know. I mean, certainly a will not to investigate. He wanted Sipe to give him all these concrete testimonies. And, of course, people didn't want to come out in public and talk about these things. But in any event, this is stuff that needs to be looked at very carefully, because, as you rightly say, Washington has had a history of McCarrick-like prelates passing through here. Cardinal Farrell, who occupies a very important post in Rome. In a certain way, Wilton Gregory as well is part of that current. And so this is not the best current. It comes through Washington, D.C. by way of the church.
Yeah, there's a DNA we're seeing here that's troubling. Also, some of those Catholics who were gathered protesting, and again, it's hard because they were protesting multiple things at once, which is always a bad idea. Stick to one thing, you're usually successful in that way. But they were also calling for the Trump administration to initiate a RICO, a racketeering investigation, against the Bishops' Conference for its use of government funds to potentially aid in the cover-up of sex abuse cases. Father, your thoughts on this? I mean, I do worry about empowering the federal government. I mean, you know, we were talking about they were very upset because in the last administration, you had the government casting an eye upon Catholics and particularly those of a traditional bent. Now you've got an administration that they want to move in a different direction. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I'm not a big fan of RICO suits unless they're actually investigating the actual Cosa Nostra of the mafia, because they're generally used as fishing expeditions to try and entrap people for whom you have little sympathy. If people have charges of specific actions that they have knowledge of and evidence, bring that forward to prosecutors, because there are plenty of laws against fraud and abuse and the misuse of government grants. So, yeah, RICO suits, unfortunately, become an easy mechanism. But it's misguided, and I think a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
I'd much rather you say, look, prosecute ex-diocese, ex-bishop, because you have evidence that you used money that was meant for one purpose for another.
I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, and I would just say, look, it's not the church as a whole. Obviously, there have been good bishops on this and bad bishops and good priests and bad priests. So to take it up to that level, it's kind of drop a nuclear bomb on a problem that needs to be dealt, as Father rightly says, with discrete operations.
Well, and then it just becomes a bonanza for plaintiff attorneys that then, you know, want to sue everybody in creation, and to make them go away, they pay these settlements, which end up shutting down your parishes. It's whether you're dealing with a guilty party or not, it's just to make it go away. That's never a good pattern. We will leave it there, gents. And of course, we'll check in with the papal posse as we roll along for commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray. You can visit thecatholicthing.org. Thank you both. He's a comic actor, a master impressionist, star of numerous classic comedy films, not to mention an early 80s cast member of Saturday Night Live when it was really Saturday Night Live. He's also author of a new memoir, packed with behind-the-scenes stories about his incredible life in showbiz and beyond. Average Joe, the memoirs of a blue-collar entertainer. Please welcome my pal, the vice chairman of the board, Mr. Joe Piscopo. Joe, thank you for being here. I'm delighted. Tell us how you got into this business, Joe, and who your first inspirations are. I thought it would be Sid Caesar or Milton Berle or somebody, but it wasn't.
Yeah, very close. And Raymond, honored to be with you always. Sure. Really, really always an honor to be with you, dear friend. And thanks for reading the book. I appreciate that very much. But, you know, the funny thing is, when I was a kid in Bloomfield, New Jersey, And we'd be watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and I just could distinctly remember, third grade maybe I was, and there was a guy, and this is really esoteric,
okay,
so stay with me if you would. There was a guy named Guy Marks, and he was a comedian out of Philadelphia. And he would do like bits. And also a guy named Frank Gorshin. These guys would do bits. They would set stages and say, what happens if this guy, if Humphrey Bogart, walks into a bar? And say, I was mesmerized by that. Not Jerry Lewis was always my icon, and you doing the greatest Jerry Lewis interview ever. You know, that's show business legend. We all know that. So Jerry was like a hero to me watching The Nutty Professor back then.
Yeah.
But these guys and Ed Sullivan doing characterizations, that caught my eye. Not the Alan Kings, not the Milton Berles, not the stand-ups, uh-huh, the guys that would just do characterization. Isn't that funny? I got sucked right into that.
Yeah, and they were kind of impressed. I mean, Frank Gorshin was a renowned impressionist. Of course, people know him from the Riddler on the old Batman show, but he was much more than that if you've ever seen his act, you know. But you say you weren't a comic, Joe Piscopo, but why were you in comedy class?
Yeah. Well, just to get a platform to become a working actor. So when I went and I got out of college, and my father, God bless him, rest his soul, was an attorney, and I knew I should have gone to law school. He could have probably got me into law school, and I would have been with him in Jersey representing, you know, the blue-collar workers like Pop did. And I said, let me try the comedy thing because, Ray, I didn't want to, like, get to an age and say, geez, I wonder what would have happened if I ever did that. So I said, I got to go to the comedy clubs. Let me get on stage. They could see me. And then all I wanted to be is what I am now, just a working actor. Are you working? It's about working. It's about the journey. Never wanted to be a star. Never wanted to be a stand-up comic. So I went, I put like 5 minutes together, went to the improvisation, 1976. When New York was really rough. You think it's bad now. It was really rough back then. And the story goes, as I said in the book, it was true. I said, let me try audition night, Sunday nights. And I went in, and I went through the Lincoln Tunnel and went around 8th Avenue, came down 9th Avenue, 44th and 9th, the legendary improvisation comedy club. Audition night, there must have been three, maybe 400 people waiting to get into audition.
400?
I had to be hundreds of people lined down 9th Avenue, right? And I looked at that line and I kept going, went right back in the Lincoln Tunnel, and I went back home and chickened out completely, you know?
tell me how Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller mentored you. You mentioned that in the book.
Oh, the best. I just saw Ben Stiller, and I just told him how Ann and Jerry were such a big influence on me. So after a while, when I went back, I would go, we would have to get there at noon to audition. And then at 8 o'clock, I remember everybody, Judy would come out, she'd hand the numbers out, and we'd get on stage. So you do audition after a while. And then Chris Albrecht, as you read in the book, was the guy that made me a regular at the improv. Meant you had to hang out in the dark, dingy bar till 2:30 in the morning and play before like four drug people. That was a regular, you know? But who was in the bar? It was Stiller and Mira. It was Ann and Jerry, and they were there, and they could not have been nicer. They were just so kind to me, and they said, "Look, you gotta work." And then they said to me, and they said, "You gotta do the commercials." I said, "I could do commercials? Yes. Yeah, somebody will come in. They'll see you on stage. You'll be able to do commercials, make money, and that's the money. So if you make money doing commercials, you can really do what you want to do in your career." And they were really influential. Could not have been nicer. We were scared. We were all scared back then.
Yeah, of course.
And Ann Mira particularly was so nice. They were sweetheart. They gave me the best advice. You want to do commercials, you'll make money, so you could go like this. You remember this, the Italian thing?
Yeah.
You could do what you want.
Yeah, and Larry David was also a comic at the same time and a writer. Was he on SNL when you were there?
He was for a minute. And he was like, let me tell you, back in the late 70s, at the comedy scene, and thank you for bringing it up, Ray, the comedy scene, it was like when comedy became rock and roll.
Right.
It just caught on. I don't know if it was Freddie Prinze Sr., whether it was Rodney, whether it was Robin Williams, it was Robert Klein. Whatever it was, it was a perfect mix of, oh, my gosh, comedy is hot. Everybody had to do comedy. And so that's when I went in there, and there was Larry David. Larry David was there. And Larry had been there a couple of years prior to when I went in.
Yeah.
So now Larry was, he would go on stage, and he would get into, like, fights with the audience. Right. He would get into the back. What you see on Curb Your Enthusiasm, yeah. That's Larry, man.
Yeah.
He'd be going. And we would all gather by the little hallway that led to the showroom, the bar to the showroom. Hey, yeah. Larry's on. And you go, Larry, back and forth with the people, fighting with the people. And it was, you know what, though? It was comic genius. You could see it was comic genius, you know? But I've never seen him do a full set because he would always leave in a huff. It was so great to watch. Back then, you know.
He'd leave in a huff. Yeah, look, we have mutual friends, and he continues that routine today, Joe. But look, tell me, leaves in a huff. Tell me what you learned when I read in the book about Rodney Dangerfield. He was the first comic I ever saw live. I was 11 years old, and I begged my mother to buy tickets to two of his shows back-to-back in New Orleans. And I sat in the front row. He insulted me for half of it. It was fantastic. What did you learn from Rodney Dangerfield?
Well, Rodney was a sweetheart, and he would come in, and I was the MC at that point.
Right.
And so I'd be on the stage at the Improv, and you could see the shadow of Rodney in the back light, in the back room, and I'll never forget this. And Rodney, I'll tell you, sweetheart, great guy, and blew that room out like nobody else. Rodney killed it. Pryor came into that room. All the greats came into that room. Nobody blew that room out. The improvisation, 44th and 9th, Hell's Kitchen in New York, late 70s, like Rodney.
Joe, I can't thank you enough for being here. And the book, Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer by Joe Piscopo, is available at bookstores everywhere. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk soon. And you all can stay tuned for the next part of this interview next week. Thank you. This week, I sat down with renowned laser eye surgeon, Dr. Ming Wang. This man is an innovator, really created a technology that saved millions of people's sight. We sat down on the Arroyo Grande podcast, and we talked about his escape from communist China and what it truly means to see. Watch.
Tell us how we can truly see. Many of us see, mm-hmm. but we don't.
Yeah.
We don't really.
Vision is fascinating. It has a very two distinct process, physical capturing of the image mm-hmm. and visual interpretation.
Ah.
And we all understand the first part. If the light comes into the eyeball versus no eye, the light comes in, okay, or scarring or something. But we underappreciate the second process, which is the visual interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who can see but don't know what they mean. People have stroke in certain part of the brain, the occipital bone, the lobe on the back. They actually could have stroke in the visual interpretation. They capture, like a camera, the eyeball, they capture image, they don't know what it means. But also, our life experience give us a visual cultural literacy. We have to have those experience to understand what we are seeing.
Mm.
That's very dependent about our ethnicity, nationality, life experience. So it is important for every citizen of the world to not only have the reading,
the visual apprehension, the image,
but also have enough cultural background
to know what it means.
To know what it means.
Dr. Wang created the amniotic lens that has saved the sight of millions of people. This is an inspiration, and the full Arroyo Grande interview with Dr. Ming Wang is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. And each week we discover life lessons to live by and offer some fun cultural commentary. Arroyo Grande, subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Visit RaymondArroyo.com. All the links are there. At least 1,300 religious minorities, including Christians, have been murdered this past week by the successor to the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. Is the new Islamic government carrying out ethnic cleansing, and can it be stopped? Joining me now to discuss this and more, senior fellow and director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea, and founder of Nazarene.org, Father Benedict Keeley. Thank you both for being here. Gunman loyal to the Sunni government of this interim president, that's what they're calling him, Ahmed al-Shara, have been carrying out or accused of carrying out revenge killings against members of Assad's minority Alawite sect. Now, they're along these coastal villages in Syria. Now, this followed what they claimed was a deadly ambush by security personnel. Nina, what is driving this murderous spree in Syria, particularly in these villages?
These people, if that they really are Alawites who are being killed, and I'm sure some of them are, many of them are Alawites, were in supporters of Assad, the former president, who was overthrown by the forces that are killing them. The forces that are killing them is now the Syrian army. It used to be, in early November, a terrorist group called HTS.
Right.
They have now come into the army, and their leader, al-Shara, is now the president. So this is still this coup or this rebellion that's playing out in the streets. Mm-hmm. And they claim that they were ambushed by the Alawites and some military people were killed, but they're responding in an indiscriminate way. There may be as many as 5,000, we're hearing, who have been killed.
Wow.
I did see reports that bodies of men of all ages are piling up in the streets of where this massacre is taking place, and their relatives and loved ones are too afraid to come out and retrieve them.
Yeah. Father Ben, you've spent time there in Syria. Give me a sense of, I mean, we're seeing reports of indiscriminate violence, as Nina mentioned. A Greek Orthodox priest was killed, but the vast majority of those killed appear to be Alawites. About 10% of Syrians belong to that sect, an offshoot of Shiite Islam. Tell us about the Alawites, and why are they being specifically targeted? Is this just vengeance against Assad and his holdouts?
It's both, Raymond. Nina's right. The Alawites, of course, President Bashar al-Assad was an Alawite, and so Alawites were in a position of power. So obviously there's hatred for them from the Sunni majority, and they are being massacred. The vast majority of people who've been killed have been Alawites, men, women, and children slaughtered, mass slaughter. It's a pogrom, really. But the other thing, to step back slightly, is they are also hated because they are considered heretics by Orthodox Islam, by Sunni Islam. And so even if they hadn't necessarily been identified with Assad, they're considered heretics and there's a desire to wipe them out. Christians are, as always, in the middle, and Christians are feeling that, luckily, thank God, there have not been that many Christians killed. There hasn't been a pogrom against them. But I always use the word yet, because what's the old phrase in Syria is, after the Alawites, next the Christians. So after there's a massacre of Alawites, usually the Christians get attacked. And that's what everyone is very, very concerned about.
And you don't believe that 1,300 number we keep hearing, that 1,300 have been slaughtered. You think the number is
there are many reports on the internet and various videos, which some of them are not authenticated, but it seems, no, the numbers are much, much larger, because many people have been killed in their apartments and houses and their bodies haven't even been discovered. It could be, as Nina said, it could be 5,000.
And Nina, why are they all being, is it because they live in such proximity?
They are living together because in the same communities because they're small minorities, religious minorities. Even when they were in power, they were small minorities. Mm. And the president and his new army are Islamist terrorists, and they had controlled Idlib province for the last 20 years. So the Syrian people and those of us paying attention know what to expect. They're hardline Islamists. They came out of al-Qaeda. They were they came out with the blessing of al-Qaeda and ISIS.
All, these were all al-Qaeda and then ISIS. This guy, the interim president of Syria, al-Shara, I mean, he claims he's going to set up an independent committee to investigate these killings. Nina, do you trust that he will investigate and hold these those who perpetuated them to account?
No, he's the pyromaniac and pretending to be a fireman. The head of the 6th century mosque, Mar Mosa, said that, you know, in this traditional Islamist regime that we've seen throughout the centuries, the Eastern Christians have had been treated either as second-class citizens at best,
yeah.
or they've been horribly and cruelly and persecuted and humiliated.
Hmm.
And so everyone's on tenterhooks trying to figure out what's going to happen yeah. next there.
Father, Ben, the violence is the worst in Syria since Assad was overthrown in December. It ended, you know, there was a 13-year devastating civil war, which claimed the lives of 600,000 people plus. 12 million were forced to flee their homes. Talk to me a bit about Syria under Assad. You were there, Father Ben. And what was the condition of the religious minority community then, particularly Christians, under the Assad regime?
Well, one will immediately be accused of being an Assad apologist, but we're dealing with facts. The reality is, of course, Assad was not a nice man. As a friend of mine said, they're all monsters. You have to just decide which monster you're going to work with. He was a terrible brute. However, this is a fact, a verifiable fact. Under his regime, Christians and all religious minorities lived in safety. And in fact, during the civil war, when the Assad regime retook places like, for example, Damascus, Christians were safe. They were not having their heads chopped off. I knew a young man from Raqqa who told me that right to back in 2011, when everything was starting, he was in the streets protesting against Assad. He told me, well, now I'm fully behind Assad. And I said, why? And he said, well, I've seen the alternative. The alternative is you get your head chopped off. So Syria, we also, for our audience, need to remember that Syria is ancient Christianity. There were no less than five popes in the 7th century from Syria. As St. John Paul used to say, our beloved John Paul, the church breathes with two lungs, the lung of the East and the West. And this is the lung of the East breathing, and we mustn't let that lung be damaged.
Yeah. Nina, I want to talk a moment about the coalition, the merger with the Kurds in the north. They're claiming that this is some kind of unity in the middle of all this turmoil. You have displaced Syrians fleeing en masse at the moment. Your thoughts on is this merger a positive sign?
I don't think it is. I have any confidence it's really going to be a merger. I think that the Kurds have a weak hand and they have no choice. And what happens to them once they give up their arms, it means that they're extremely vulnerable and they could be next. It's an ethno and religious conflict going on in Syria.
I want to play this soundbite for both of you and get your reaction. This is a displaced Syrian. Many of them are going to Lebanon, and that's a powder keg itself. And they say the suffering is very high. It is a complete extermination of the Alawite sect and of our brothers, and our brothers the Christians, and our brothers the Shiite. They do not want anyone. Father, I'll start with you. Your reaction. Will the current regime target the Christian population once the Alawites are dealt with?
This is the big question. We're talking about al-Sharaa. We were joking earlier that he shaved off his beard. He's wearing a suit. But the big question is, will an Islamist leopard change his spots? The jury is out, and the jury is rather nervous, I think. If I was a Christian in Syria, I know them, I speak to them regularly, they are extremely nervous. There's a hope, there's a possibility, but they're very, very nervous about what could come next.
What is the mood among the Christians there, Nina?
Yeah, I think that they're more than nervous. I've talked to two patriarchs recently, and they express deep concern. I've gotten letters saying that there's, you know, very high levels of anxiety.
Sure.
And it's not just al-Sharaa, the president. It's also his coalition, which include extreme extremists.
Hmm.
And I've seen this in Nigeria and elsewhere, where the government, who doesn't like the minorities to begin with, doesn't want to deal with the Christians,
right.
just lets the extreme fringes take care of them, and he doesn't lift a finger to protect them.
Mm.
And I predict that that's what's going to happen. We're going to see that, because he wants Western support.
Yeah.
He wants sanction relief from the United States. And he knows if he goes out and has his army slaughtering the Christians, it's not going to happen. So he's going to let others do it.
The British Foreign Minister, David Lammy, and U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio both responded to the violence in Syria, but only Rubio called out the radical Islamists for targeting these religious minorities. I'll first go to Nina, then to Father Ben. Why aren't we hearing more about these atrocities in the West?
Well, I think that it's still considered politically incorrect to talk about this. That to I think it helps Muslims because you can distinguish extremists from others, from non-extremists. Mm-hmm. And instead, they are silent on it. Everyone knows it's going on, and they're thinking the worst, that all Muslims are extreme.
Father Ben, your reaction.
Well, as I write in my article in The Spectator appearing on Friday, this is a classic example of Western, pathetic Western response that Lammy, the British Foreign Secretary, just expressed horror at the violence. Thanks be to God, Marco Rubio, as you said, identified Islamist extremists, and he mentioned the attacks on religious minorities. So through with the new Trump administration, we're getting some honesty. But from the EU, we got an appalling response from the European Union. It's the decaying West once again, happily watching Christians being slaughtered. Meanwhile, while their own countries are being taken over as well.
Well, they're not even watching in some cases. They're not seeing it, Father Ben. But for Twitter and a few other places, you can't find that. I mean, we did the first reporting on Fox on this, and that was the first, I think, of any national media. It's been a complete blackout, and I don't understand why. Maybe it's they don't fully grasp the situation, or maybe they just don't want to report on this. Nina?
I don't think they want to report on it. They are uncomfortable with defending Christians. There's particular animus against Christians in certain sectors. They see Christians as the oppressors, and that's, you know, they can't release
it
themselves from that.
It frustrates the narrative.
Yeah.
Nina, before we go, I've got to get your reaction to this, and Father Ben, you can chime in as well. Some stories coming out of China. Underground Catholic Bishop Peter Zhumin was arrested after refusing to pay a $27,000 fine for celebrating a Jubilee Year Mass. The CCP, the communist authorities, claim it was an illegal mass. His whereabouts remain unknown. Meanwhile, Nina, Pope Francis just appointed a Chinese biologist and reported CCP loyalist to the Pontifical Academy for Sciences. Where are we now, and why is the Vatican so silent on the arrest of their own bishops?
Yeah, Bishop Peter Shao, he was doing nothing wrong, even by their own laws. He is an underground priest, but he's still allowed to say Mass. And he was doing it for the Pope. He's praying for the Pope. He has his diocese, vibrant diocese, saying the rosary for the Pope's health. And he gets put away in indefinite secret detention. This is about the seventh time since the Vatican agreement was signed with the Communist Party. It's really atrocious. The Vatican should be speaking up. I understand the Pope's sick. But where is the Secretary of State Parolin? Why isn't he saying something to protest this, to protect his bishops? This was a bishop that was anointed by Pope Benedict.
Yes.
On the other hand, someone, I don't know if it's Pope Francis, who's very, very ill, appointed this new Academy of
Papal Biologists.
Who is doing experiments on embryos, embryonic development. That's his
specialty,
and cloning and so forth. And he was appointed to the Chinese Academy of Sciences by the government of China. It's a rare privilege. It means tenure, lifetime tenure. Mm. And you don't do this just because you have on merit. You do this because it could be he's very smart.
He's a party
scientist,
loyalist.
But he's a party loyalist. And he's someone who's going to use this position in the academy,
the Pontifical Academy in Rome,
not only to spy, but to influence, to shape the narrative about China wherever he goes. And he's going to leverage that in the United Nations and in Europe, in the European Commission and so forth, European Union. So it's very dangerous to have someone like that who is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party.
But Nina and Father Ben, we've got a number of bishops who have been appointed by the Chinese authorities that the Vatican gave rubber stamps to. I mean, they're very quick to react to spending cuts here in the U.S. Congress. But what does it tell you? That there's absolute silence when it comes to the arrest of a loyal bishop just saying mass.
Well, Raymond, you've been speaking about this for years. Nina, of course, is an expert in this area. I think this Vatican-China agreement is one of the greatest scandals in the life of the church in the last probably half a century.
Yeah.
Though many people like Lord David Alton and others who've always been quite quiet and very respectful have spoken up because Chinese Catholics, faithful Chinese Catholics, are being persecuted, another part of the persecuted church. And you ask who's making these appointments. Well, we have to wonder if the Pope is so sick, as he is, we know, mm-hmm. who is making the Cardinal, the Secretary of State, Cardinal Parolin, is the man who made this agreement. Is he pulling the strings now? It's a very shocking thing. We must speak up with great respect for the Pope, but we must speak up about our brethren who are being persecuted for the faith. They've been faithful to the Pope. That's one of the reasons why the underground church is an underground church, because they were faithful to the Pope. But now they feel that the rug is being pulled from under them for being faithful.
Yeah. Nina, I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, Cardinal Parolin, let's not forget, was the architect of this agreement that was signed in 2018, the Vatican-China agreement. So he doesn't want to admit that it's been a complete failure.
Well, and one wonders, why are we seeing these appointments of Chinese apparatchiks to major Vatican dicasteries and academies? It's very bizarre and not hard to unravel. But, you know, Father and Nina, I'll leave you with this. I do believe, and I've been talking to a number of cardinals over the last few days, this is going to be a major sticking point, and I think an issue, going into the next conclave. They recognize, the bishops and cardinals at large recognize, there is a problem here with this China-Vatican pact. And the fact that it's been kept secret, and I do believe it will shape whoever the next pope will be. We will leave it there. You can find more of Nina Shea's reporting on the persecution of Christians worldwide by visiting Hudson.org and follow Father Benedict Keeley. He's at Nazarean.org. Thank you both. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week and part two of my interview with Joe Piscopo. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.